Just by way of recap, as we began last Wednesday evening to look at the prophet Nahum, we said that the name Nahum means comfort or strengthening, or it can be taken as meaning repentance, but also how the name, the H, ought to be a hard H, almost like a ah sound. So Nahum rather than Nahum, as we tend to say it. And he is from Galilee in Elkoshite, Elkesi, almost certainly the village from which he would have come, though nobody's quite sure of the location of that now. And the theme of this prophecy is the overthrow of the city of Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, a particularly brutal pagan empire, and the first of the great superpowers outside of Egypt in the ancient world. And Nineveh was the capital city of it, and of course we're all familiar with the book of Jonah, how the Ninevites repented and turned to the Lord, and that was all great and well and good, but that was about 150 years before this prophecy. Before the prophecy of Nahum, and before Nineveh and Assyria has become the mighty and brutal empire that it did become. And this prophecy of the overthrow of Nineveh is likewise given approximately 100 years before its actual fulfillment. So if something was happening now, this year, and had been prophesied 100 years earlier, it would have been prophesied in 1919. So it's if somebody had the gift of prophecy and in 1919 said such and such is going to happen in 2019 and then it comes to pass this year. That's the time span that we're looking at here. Now, the theme of this prophecy, as we said, the overthrow of Nineveh, is couched in terms both of the fearful, frightening, destructive power of God's judgments, but also of the safety and protection that he is to those who fear him and love him. It is said of the Duke of Wellington that when he reviewed his own troops, and most of the troops, of course, in those days, the rank and file were made up of those whom the Duke perhaps somewhat patronizingly regarded as the scum of the earth, the absolute lowest socioeconomic order. But once their natural rough and ready aggression was honed and trained to work together as a military machine in precision and obeying orders, he is reputed to have said that he didn't know what they would do to the enemy, but they certainly terrified the life out of him. Now, we might with reverence apply something of that to the Lord. Whatever he will do to the enemy, the fury of his judgments terrifies us who are on his side, or seek to be his children, to be his followers, to hide under the shadow of his wings. But his destructive judgment is nevertheless terrifying, fearful. And there is a fearfulness in this judgment upon Nineveh, which of course, as we said, wouldn't come to be fulfilled for another 100 years from the time of the prophecy. And of course, ultimately, all these things point us forward to Christ, because at the end of days it is Christ who will sit upon the throne. Paul tells us we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, and that will be for those who are lost, even for those of us who seek to be his children, to follow him. It will be, to an extent, a frightening experience. For those who are lost, it will be a terrifying experience. But there is an appropriate fear as we face the prospect of God's judgment. Now, of course, for those who are in Christ, the judgment, or the price of that judgment, has been borne already by the Lord upon the cross. Nevertheless, we must each give an account of everything that we have done in this life. If we take up where we left off at the end of last Wednesday, verse 7, the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. And this is the great encouragement for the Lord's people. In Nahum's day, it was the kingdom of Judah, the Israelites who depended upon the Lord, although they weren't always as faithful as they should be. He's good, he's a stronghold in the day of trouble, and of course the day of trouble will come. And he knoweth them that trust in him. But with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof. and darkness shall pursue his enemies. Now you could preach a whole sermon just on this single verse 8. The overrunning flood. Now, sometimes in the recent weeks we've seen the likes of flash floods and that have happened either on the mainland or in England or whatever. And you see on the news or on the TV, you see the torrents of water pouring down streets and down steps and so on, and turning them into a waterfall, cars getting to floating away and people struggling to get through the water. Now that doesn't just gradually rise up, that's when it suddenly comes with a deluge of rain, and there's no escaping from it. You can't outrun a flood that's following you. You can't sort of really escape it if it's deep enough. With an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof. The flood, of course, is not ultimately a flood of water. God has promised that will never again destroy the whole earth. Even where he uses limited floods to achieve his purposes at other times in parts of the world, yet nevertheless it's really a flood of judgment that is being spoken of here. He will make an utter end of the place thereof. Now the word thereof in the Hebrew is in a feminine term. And this is taking the city of Nineveh as being, pictorially we might say, a queen sitting in the midst of all her splendor, all her kingdom, all her power and glory. And there she sits, the place thereof, where she has her throne, where she has her power. And that is Nineveh. That is the capital of the Assyrian Empire. The darkness shall pursue the Lord's enemies. Now, we might think, well, darkness isn't so bad, but then that's limited darkness. We think of darkness where you can have a little bit of light, darkness where the stars light up the sky, darkness where you can sleep, and then the dawn will come, you wake up again. But darkness, as the plague of darkness in Egypt, even such a darkness that may be felt, where there is no relief from the blackness, where there is no spark of light, where there is no means of your eyes becoming accustomed to it, just sheer darkness, the complete absence of the one who is the light of the world. This is one way in which, of course, in the New Testament it's described as people being cast into outer darkness. It means that where the comforting light of the Lord's presence does not choose to come. God can't be kept out of anywhere, but he may choose to withdraw his comfortable presence from some places. So darkness shall pursue his enemies. It's almost like you picture somebody trying to run away from darkness that's following like a great big black cloud and then engulfs them. And they simply can't see anything. And of course, when we have not the light of the Lord, we can't see anything. We are in complete darkness. Some people continue in that darkness and they think this is normal. It's not what God intended, of course. He intended souls to be saved and to be brought to the light. Verse 9 is addressing itself to the Assyrian power. What do ye imagine against the Lord? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. Now what we have in verse 9 is really sort of a parallel with what we have in Isaiah 37. And I'll just, you don't have to turn it up just now, but I'll just turn the page myself and read you these few verses. In verse 23, it says, whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high? Even against the Holy One of Israel. This is addressed to the Assyrian power at the time when they were infesting and surrounding Jerusalem. By thy servants thou hast reproached the Lord and hast said, by the multitude of my chariots am I come up to the height of the mountains, to the sides of Lebanon, and I will cut down the tall cedars thereof and the choice fir trees thereof, and I will enter into the height of his border and the forest of his Carmel. I have digged and drunk water, and with the sole of my feet have I dried up all the rivers of the besieged places. Hast thou not heard long ago how I have done it, and of ancient times, that I have formed it? Now have I brought it to pass that thou shouldst be to lay waste defense cities into ruinous heaps. Therefore their inhabitants were of small power. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as grass on the field, and as the green herb, as the grass on the housetops, and as corn blasted before it be grown up. But I know thy abode, and thy going out, and thy coming in, and thy rage against me. Because thy rage against me and thy tumult is come up into mine ears, Therefore I will put my hook in thy nose, and my bridle in thy lips, and I will turn thee back by the way by which thou camest. Now this is Isaiah 37. He's got a similar message then for the Assyrian power when it comes up against Judah. And it's no surprise to us that there should be overlap between different ones of the Lord's prophets. If you were to go and listen to 10 different ministers who are of the Reformed faith and Bible believing, preaching and so on, you would find quite a bit of overlap in the message they preach, because they're all preaching the same gospel from the same Bible, in the sense of its essential content. And they would give a very similar core message, as you would expect. So there is likewise overlap between the prophets of God, Nahum and Isaiah and various others as well. Now, when it says, affliction shall not rise up the second time, this, of course, is a reference to Assyria not coming again to attack the Jews, the Israelites, in that sense. They'd already destroyed northern Israel, but their attempt to destroy Jerusalem was overthrown, of course, by the Lord. Now, this is not unlike what we have at verse 12. We just skip ahead to verse 12 for a second. It says, thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet, that is the Assyrians, and likewise many, yet thus shall they be cut down when he shall pass through. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. Now, most commentators take this to mean, though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more, meaning that this is addressed to the Jewish people. That although they have been afflicted by the Assyrian power, though they have been crushed, they have been chastised, God will bring that chastisement, that punishment, to an end. The punishments of the Lord's people, the chastisements and sufferings of the Lord's people, are temporary and have a purpose in them. They are corrective and they are temporary. The punishments that he metes out to those who are his enemies are permanent and fearful. So most people take the latter part of that verse 12, though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more, as applying to the Jewish nation. However, it has to be said that as illustrious a commentator as John Calvin himself takes this verse 12, though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more, to be addressed to the Assyrians in the sense of, I am going to afflict you in such a way that I will never need to do it again. And the sense of that is, if we look at what Abishai says to David, he says, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, talking about Saul, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time. The sense there is of the destruction being so complete, so absolute, that it's not necessary to inflict it a second time. Likewise in chapter 3 and verse 12 of 1 Samuel, when the prophet is speaking, or rather when the Lord is speaking to the child Samuel about what he's going to do to Eli's house, it says, in that day I will perform against Eli all things which I have spoken concerning his house. When I begin, I will also make an end. When I begin, I will make an end. I'll smite, and I won't need to smite a second time. And Calvin takes this as being, though I have afflicted thee, Assyria, I will afflict thee no more, in the sense of, I won't need to hit you a second time. Now, that's one, of course, one has to respect what Calvin said, but personally, I wouldn't be inclined to say that the context lends itself to that. But we have to, of course, not always agree together as brethren, agree to disagree on some things. But going back to verse 10, while they be fallen together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble fully dry. Now the sense here is of somebody trying to clear land, trying to clear it of a whole big intertwined like edge of thorns, and instead of sort of trying to tease out the individual strands in order to destroy the thorns, and the thorns of course symbolize the enemies of the Lord's people, it's easier just to drag out the whole great intertwined ball and mass of it and stick it all on the fire together. You know, nowadays if somebody is replacing a fence, you'll often see that maybe they've bound up, rolled up all the barbed wire or whatever into a ball, and then they just dump it, of course. But where it's thorns, organic material, whether you have to roll it up and fold it into a ball, or whether it's all just naturally intertwined and tangled together, you drag it all out and you just stick it on the fire together. When it's folded together, intertwined, as little as thorns can resist the flame, so likewise they won't be able to resist the Lord. And while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble fully dry. Now, in one sense, this is easy to understand. A drunkard, of course, is loud and boastful usually. He'll be full of all the exploits of what he can do, and in his cups he'll be loud and proud and ready to say, oh, I'll do this, and oh, anybody tries to mess with me, of course I'll see them off, I'll make sure I show them who's boss. But that's the drink talking. And a drunkard, of course, may fall down himself, without having to be pushed, but it will be so easy to overpower somebody who is weakened in that way by being drunk. So for all the big, proud boasts, yet he is in fact completely helpless and weak. And this is like the Assyrian boast against the Lord, who has lifted himself up in this way and sought to boast against the Lord, say all the great things he was going to do against the Lord of hosts. But also in the original, there's a sense here, while they are drunken, the Hebrew word for drunken is soaked as in one's own wine. And there's a contrast here, while they are soaked as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble fully dry. So there's a contrast going on there. The stubble that's totally dry will be burned up, even as those who are soaked in their own wine. They may be as wet as anything, but they'll still be devoured as though they were dry as sticks, ready to be burned. There is one come out of thee that imagineth evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. Literally, it's a counselor of Belial. Belial is a phrase, a man of Belial, a counselor of Belial, a daughter of Belial, that you'll find lots of times in the Old Testament. What it means is one which is without profit, without in the sense of P-R-O-F-I-T, that is profitless, that is worthless. If something is of Belial, it is pure vanity. It is worthless. Therefore, it is completely not of the Lord. Because nothing of the Lord is worthless. Nothing of the Lord is vanity or empty or useless. It all has purpose. It all has meaning. It all has power. It all has reality. But that which is of Belial is like, froth in the air. It's just empty, valueless, worthless. And this one that has come out from Assyria, boasting himself against the Lord, all the great things he's going to do, it's just like the boasts of a drunkard, which can be easily pushed over with one finger. And although he may be well soaked, he'll be burned up like dry stubble and thorns. So we're back to this verse 12. Thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet and likewise many, yet thus shall they be cut down. Now when it says cut down, the sense, it's literally shorn. And it's the sense of cut really close with a razor. Now in the past, the Lord had prophesied through Isaiah how he would use the Assyrians as a razor to shave down, to cut down, to punish those who lifted themselves up against the Lord. They thought they were great and strong and powerful and could do false gods to their heart's content. And God said, well, you want false gods? I'll bring a power that worships false gods. I'll bring them and visit them on you, and then see how you like that. See how comfortable you are with those that really worship false gods. In Isaiah 7 at verse 20 it says, in the same day shall the Lord shave with a razor that is hired, namely by them beyond the river, by the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it shall also consume the beard. The Assyrians were used by the Lord as a razor to cut down, to cut really close to the skin, to slice away all the proud pagan opposition to him within Israel. But now those who have been the razor in the hand of the Lord are themselves to be cut down in the sense of being shaved, of being shorn. That's the sense of it here. Yet shall they be cut down, like shaved with a razor. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. Now, one reason I would respectfully disagree with Calvin here is that in verse 12, though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more, for now will I break his yoke from off thee. The thee in this context clearly would imply those who are going to be set free from the yoke. That would be the Jewish people. That would be the kingdom of Judah. Now will I break his yoke from off thee. Calvin is likening verse 12 to what we find at verse 9. In the context, it might be more appropriate to apply it to what we find at verse 13. For now will I break his yoke from off thee, and will burst thy bonds in sunder. And the Lord hath given a commandment concerning thee. That's the sense of it here. A commandment that no more of thy name be sought. Now, we already made reference last week to the end of 2 Kings chapter 19, where we have seen how Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came against Jerusalem, and how then he was destroyed. He was destroyed not by the kings of Judah going out and defeating him in battle, but rather by the Lord moving with his angel through the camp of Assyria and simply causing them all to die. Well, not every last one of them, but 4,500 of them. The angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians, and 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. Now, no army can recover from that kind of loss. Suddenly, to wake up in the morning, with only a handful of you left, 185,000 troops are suddenly just dead in their tents. So, what can you do? You have to retreat, and pretty quick. So, the angel of the Lord delivered them. So, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer, his sons, smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. So although they were quiet, although they were not doing it, they were just in camp, the Lord silenced them. He smote them, though they be many, and likewise quiet. Yet thus shall they be cut down. Though I have afflicted thee, Judah, I will afflict thee no more. The Lord hath given a commandment concerning thee, that no more of thy name be sown. Out of the house of thy gods will I cut off the graven image and the molten image. I will make thy grave, for thou art vile. In other words, your tomb, your sepulchre, will be the house of your gods. This is what we just made reference to. How Sennacherib himself was murdered, assassinated, by his own sons in his own pagan temple. Now, as far as the pagans were concerned, that would have defiled the temple of Nisroch, the fact that somebody had been murdered in it. So they couldn't use it until it had been ritually purified again or whatever. So it defiled with his own blood the temple of his false gods. The house of thy gods will I cut off the graven image and the molten image. I will make thy grave, thy sepulchre, tomb there, for thou art vile. Also, this is a reference to the fact that when Assyria finally was overthrown, when Nineveh was destroyed, it was destroyed by the Medes, along with others, who, for whatever reason, although they were pagans, although they weren't worshippers of the true God, they apparently had an inbuilt hatred of idols, of statuary, in terms of worship. And so they set about removing and destroying and smashing up all the idols, all the graven images, all the false gods of the Assyrians. And this was part of the destruction of Assyria. They literally destroyed the idolatry and all the statues and so on. In the house of thy gods will I cut off the graven images. Now, of course, that wouldn't happen for another 100 years. But here it is prophesied by Nahum as to what will be done. It wasn't by the Israelites it was done. It was by another completely alien, foreign, pagan power. But the Lord uses one power to overthrow another. Just as he used the Assyrians to punish those who were rebellious in Israel, so in due course, he overthrew the Assyrians by means of the Medes, and then the Babylonians rose up in their place. God got rid of the Assyrians and brought in the Babylonians. He then got rid of the Babylonians by means of the Persians and the Medes. And then got rid of the Persians by means of the Greeks. Got rid of the Greeks by means of the Romans. And so on. So the Lord, although he will allow pagan powers to ascend and be great for a while, he will then remove them when the time comes, perhaps using another equally godless power, because the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Now, when we think in terms of how great Assyria was, how impossible it would have seemed for Israel ever to be delivered from them, which of course they weren't delivered by any military prowess, they were delivered by means of, as we said, the angel of the Lord going through the camp of the Assyrians and just quietly killing 185,000 of them, so they died as far as we can tell in their sleep. And then Sennacherib withdrew. He withdrew, he went back to his own country, and then the news would have reached them that he was dead, that he had been killed by his own sons in the temple of his own gods. Now, this is the context in which you get, "Behold, upon the mountains, the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace." And I think, well, that's not very nice, is it? Celebrating the fact that somebody's dead. But the person who is dead is the one who had already destroyed northern Israel and now had sought to destroy Jerusalem and Judah and the Lord's temple and the Lord's people. And the only reason he hadn't was because the Lord intervened directly. And then they would hear, not immediately, but they would hear once the news traveled back from Nineveh, traveled back from Assyria, that their great oppressor was no more. And they would be relieved in the sense that they would be able to know that there was peace. This is the one who brings peace. Again, very similar to what we read in Isaiah 52 at verse 7. "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth." It is the Lord who delivered Jerusalem. It is the Lord who saves his people. So the response then to Judah, the reason there's peace, is because the enemy has been overthrown. And the only person who has overthrown the enemy is the Lord. Same with our salvation. Just as the Jews could not go out against the Assyrians, could not use any military strength, for they didn't have any, to defeat this vast army, 185,000 plus, they could do nothing themselves. When they were delivered, it was exclusively by the hand of the Lord. And then that was topped off by Sennacherib eventually being killed as well. So likewise with our salvation, we don't have any strength of our own. The enemy comes in like a flood. We are holed up, as it were, cowering under the shadow of the wings of the Lord, who nevertheless simply utters his voice. And not only the earth melts, but all the enemies melt away as well. It is by the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. Great is his faithfulness. It is by the Lord's own sacrifice that we are delivered. It is the Lord alone who saves, that publisheth peace. Peace between God and man because of what Christ has done. O Judah, keep thy solemn feasts. Perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. And the exhortation here is that no doubt in the time of their extremity, a great many of the Jews would have said, "Oh Lord, if you just deliver us, if you just take away this great threat that's around us, we'll be faithful, we'll sacrifice peace offerings, we'll worship in your house, we'll come back to you, Lord, we promise, we promise." And the Lord does deliver them. So this is the exhortation from the prophet. So come back then, O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. We could also take it, of course, bearing in mind that the fulfillment of this prophecy is a century away, that it could be taken by the prophet Nahum as, because this is going to happen, you stay close to the Lord now, fulfill your vows, keep your solemn feast, keep close with the Lord, because you are so going to need him when the time comes. The time to make your peace with God is now, not in 100 years' time. You may or may not live to see this great deliverance he's going to do, but whether you do or not, make your peace with him now. As Paul writes to the Corinthians, now is the accepted time. Now is the day of salvation. O Judah, keep thy solemn feast. Perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. And here's again part of the warning of this prophecy. All who are at enmity with the Lord will ultimately be cut off. That is the choice, the stark choice that is before us. All who are at enmity with the Lord will perish, but those who are safe in him will be preserved. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. He knows. Do we know ourselves what is for our good? Did those in Nahum's day know? Well, some of them would, and some of them wouldn't, which is why they have to be told and told and told again how good